The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
When I was at the monastery recently, I started to read Hakuin's book by Norman Waddell called Wild Ivy. And Hakuin actually wrote a lot about himself and his practice to just articulate his process. And I've been reading it because, as some of you know, I've been integrating art into teishos, into talks, and it's something that Hakuin did, and it's part of the Obaku line of Rinzai Zen, where they had a art expression within the lineage, Shakuhachi, and there were many painter priests, so I thought, let me read about Hakuin and see if I could find anything about his lectures and when he pulled out the brush and I haven't found anything yet, but that he painted a lot, and he wasn't a trained painter either, and he had such a wide variety of expression. He could be very kind of realistic and just be very bold with just splatter, you know, just from the horror, bah, you know, whatever teaching was needed. And he worked a lot with the laity and illiterate, you know. So I wanted to reread his Song of Zazen that we chanted, so you can just hear this again. And he calls it a Song of Zazen, which is kind of nice. All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by water by nature is water. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. How sad that people ignore the near and search for truth afar, like someone in the midst of water, crying out in thirst, like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor, lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. From dark path to dark path we wander. When shall we be freed from birth and death? For this, the Zazen of the Mahayana deserves the highest praise. Offerings, precepts, paramitas, nembetsu, atonement, practice, the many virtues all rise within Zazen. Those who try, even once, wipe away immeasurable crimes. Where are all the dark paths then? The pure land itself is near. Those who hear this truth even once and listen with a grateful heart, treasuring it, revering it, gain blessings without end. Much more, if you turn yourself about and confirm your own self-nature, that self-nature is no nature. You are far beyond mere argument. The oneness of cause and effect is clear. Not two, not three. The path is put right with form that is no form. Going and coming, never astray. With thought that is no thought, singing and dancing are the voice of the law. Boundless and free in the sky of samadhi. Bright, the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana's here before your eyes. That's peace. This very land is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. That was Robert Aiken's translation. Hak Win lived from 1685 to 1768. Very dynamic teacher. He was credited with singly revitalizing the Japanese Zen Rinzai school after 300 years of decline. He was so fired up, this guy. And from a very young age, he had a lot of loss. And he heard somebody, I don't know if it was a teacher, I can't remember what, but somebody gave this like fire and brimstone threatening talk about, like, if you do something wrong, you're going to end up in these hell realms. He couldn't sleep for like weeks as a young kid, and he would ask his mother, like, am I going to, like, you know, where am I going to end up? And it bothered him so much. And then she had passed away, and he was kind of on his own. So he went into a monastery very young. And he placed special emphasis on brush teachings and koan practice. And he even invented a lot of new koans himself. Some of them we know, and we even see them on tea bags. Like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's Hakuin's. And the teacher will, and that's in our koan system. What is the sound of one hand clapping? And the teacher will say, show me, don't tell me. And then there's a whole series of Hakuin questions about this one hand clapping. So he was, as I said, he was very invested in spreading the teachings to laity and illiterate. And he wasn't shy about people should have kensho. People should have a direct experience of their nature in a thorough and illustrative way. He wrote, never ask your teachers to explain. But when your activity of mind is exhausted and your capacity for feeling comes to a dead end, if something should take place, not unlike the cat springing up upon the mouse or the mother hen hatching her eggs, then a great flash of livingness surges up. This is the moment when the phoenix escapes from the golden net and when the crane breaks the bars of its cage. And he'll paint this too, if you can't understand it by words, he'll illustrate it for you. When a person faces the great doubt before them, there is in all directions only a vast empty land without birth and without death, like a large plain of ice extending 10,000 miles. As though seated within a vase of lapis lazuli, surrounded by absolute purity, within their heart there is not the slightest thought or emotion. It is just as though they were standing in complete emptiness. At this time, when they advance single-mindedly without retrogression, suddenly it will be as though a sheet of ice was broken or a jade tower had fallen. They will experience a great joy, one that never in many years has one seen or heard. So. So this is his teaching poem, this Song of Zazen, meditation. And it encapsulates the merits of Zazen. And he encourages students to focus on the immediate presence right here, right now. The immediate presence, just this very momentness. And he speaks of the many virtues and practices within the Zen tradition and said Zazen contains them all. A form that is no form, as he speaks of in the poem. A form that is no form, where singing and dancing are the voice of the law. Anyway, this somehow led me to thinking about silence and noble silence. Noble silence is Muna, M-O-U-N-A, the Buddha spoke of, which is measurement. Which is about measurement and our willingness. He says, measurement. Buddha pointed to the measurement of words when practiced leads to more meaningful and powerful speech. So when our in silence, in that measuring of words, when we do speak out of this silence, the words are much more powerful. So what is our willingness to encounter silence? I was just like, what is silence? And, you know, sometimes it's got so many different faces because, you know, Audre Lorde on one hand will say, your silence will not protect you. So that's speaking to a certain kind of silence where we just don't say things when maybe we should, and it's protective. And then Rumi will say, let that silence take you to the core of your life. And Hakuin speaks of this thunderous silence. And I don't know, it just was something to contemplate. It's come up a lot because I have to speak a lot and I choose sometimes to just remain silent. And so I'm like, what is the silence? What is the silence? When is silence not being silent, actually? And it's hardly touchable. In the practice, we could say silence might correspond to having a right view. Seeing impermanence is silence, is seeing the silence of things. That thunderous silence, that it's impermanent, that everything is appearing and disappearing and changing from moment to moment, that kind of silence. Shunryu Suzuki talks about presence as that which carries us through the difficulty of ups and downs. When you suffer, you should suffer. When you feel good, you should feel good. It's the willingness to engage with any set of circumstances to directly encounter the most difficult aspects of our own selves that gives us the true joy that is part of the meditative practice. And I was thinking about that and how when we enter that silence of that true feeling of feeling, engaging with feeling good or just suffering purely, there's a measure of joy there because we're actually doing that so fully, if you've ever felt that. It's a right view. It's right understanding. We're in alignment without calling it something. We taste it differently. We taste it differently. Appearing and disappearing, changing from moment to moment. I could know for myself this feeling. And it was joy that emerged, a kind of joy. Does it sound like I contradict myself? Then I contradict myself, as Whitman would say. But impermanence is not something we see objectively. It's something that we taste directly. Impermanence makes me silent. Makes me silent. Because impermanence is very quiet. But this, we're silent, but at the same time, we're many words, many explanations, many representations, many dynamic actions, physical, mental. All this is present. And silence seems to be something very deep, yet very active. In Japanese, the word for silence is Mokurai. And moku means silence and rai means thunder. That's the word for silence. So silence is quiet, but there's an enormous voice there like a thunder. And in practice and zazen, I think we're sitting into the quiet and hearing that thunder of that silence. I remember I told you, many of you know, I was an apprentice to Toshiko Takaezu, my clay teacher. And part of my apprenticeship was a whole life there, you know. It was making food and guests and wasn't just clay, you know, working in the garden. And we planted tomatoes, and I picked one that was kind of turning red. It wasn't quite red and ripe. And I put it on the windowsill, and we were having breakfast. And I was really excited about this tomato. It was like the first one. And I saw her see it, and thunderous silence. And I could feel that roar like you would not believe. She was at the sink, and I put it on the windowsill. And she washed her hands and filled the tea kettle. She didn't say a word to me yet. Nothing. And we went about our breakfast. I could hardly chew, and I can hardly swallow. And she had this, if you knew her, she had a very straight face, stern at that moment. And she wouldn't look at me, and I was just fidgeting at the breakfast table on my high seat on our bench stool. And we started eating, and she shouted out, "No, you shouldn't have picked that tomato." I was like, finally. Yeah. And she went through a whole list of my attributes at that moment: impatience, impetuousness. She just like this must have been like on her like book, just all these ways that I, in a really loving way too, I must say, like she named them, but she was also not hating me. She was really holding me really beautifully. That was the end of my breakfast. But, and then there's a story of Shakyamuni Buddha, where he remained silent to this student, Malunkyaputta. So Malunkyaputta asked the Buddha this question, these questions, whether the Buddha would exist forever, whether the world is eternal, and whether the world is structured by spiritual or by material forces. And the Buddha remained silent. And so this is something people work with. What was this Buddha's silence, thunderous silence, in response to Malunkyaputta's metaphysical questions? And part of that we can understand with this parable of the arrow, where the Buddha was sitting in a park and this disciple Malunkyaputta comes and recently retired from the world, was concerned with so many things that remained unexplained by the Buddha. And these questions: was the world eternal or not eternal? Was the soul different from the body? Did the enlightened exist after death or not? And he thought, if the Buddha doesn't explain these things to me, I'll give up training and I'll return to the worldly life. Have we done that with our teacher? If you don't explain it to me, I'm out of here. So the Buddha replied, "Now, did I ever say to you that you led a religious life, you would understand these things? It is as if a person had been wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and their friends, companions, and relatives were to get a surgeon to heal them, and they were to say, 'I will not have this arrow pulled out until I know who wounded me.' Of what caste are they? What is their name? Are they tall? Are they short? Are they medium or in height? What color is their skin? Where did they come from? What kind of bow was I wounded with? What is it made of? Was the arrow's feather from a vulture wing, a heron's, or a hawk's? Surely, this person would die before they knew all this." The Buddha says, whether the view is held that the world is eternal or not, makkhala putta, there is still rebirth, old age, death, grief, suffering, sorrow, and despair. And these can be destroyed in this life. I have not explained these other things because they are not useful. They are not conducive to tranquility and nirvana. What I've explained is suffering, the cause of suffering, the destruction of suffering, and the path that leads to the destruction of suffering. This is useful, leading to non-attachment, the absence of passion, perfect knowledge. Thus the Buddha spoke, and with joy, Makkhalaputta applauded his words. Buddha keeps pointing us towards wisdom. When we're suffering, what kind of questions are we asking? And are they relieving us or ours suffering? Where are they leading? What are the questions that are helpful? So, Katagiri Roshi, in Returning to Silence, speaks about some of these characteristics of the Buddha's silence. And he says, the first characteristic is emptiness. That's right. Everything is produced by independent co-origination, which means there's nothing to hold on to because everything's interconnected very closely, appearing and disappearing at super speed. So we're in motion. Everything is. There's nothing but activity. This dynamic, incredible dynamic functioning that we see moment to moment is called emptiness. Remember? Emptiness is exactly form. Form is exactly emptiness. It's dynamic, moving constantly. That's the first characteristic of Buddha's silence. So when we chant the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, no body, no mind, these words no and not, to show us nothing has a separate existence, where everything's interconnected, sewn together, with a little jewel at each intersection. The koan mu is no, not, pointing us in this direction. The second characteristic of Buddha's silence is oneness. He said oneness is realizing the wholeness of existence instead of being content with knowing one small aspect, and is characterized by reflecting upon the self with an open heart that accepts and respects others. So we have another parable with that elephant where, and Ayo Yatundi spoke of this in our retreat on microaggressions, where there's an elephant and we're kind of blind with ignorance, and you grab a part and it's maybe it's the tusk and you say, ah, it's really hard. And then it's another person feels like a tail and it's like, oh, it's skinny and taut. And, you know, so each person has a part, but we, for wisdom, we need to come out from the parts and see a larger web and not just be on these smaller, the wholeness of the existence, not just knowing one small aspect. He says to understand we have our own opinion and then to see our opinion in relation to other people's opinions. When we see our opinion and others' opinions are as one whole, it's pretty hard to fight each other. Wow. Wow. Especially in light of some conversations I've heard lately. It's pretty hard to fight each other. It's all connected. So we are quiet. It makes us quiet when we taste the pain and the suffering very deeply. Don't you find it hard to say anything? We know who we are in that silence together. And this is related to our past and to our future and to the present, right here now. When we really understand this not to, we taste silence and we see silence. He says, when, where, how, depends on our practice. We need to practice being quiet. He says, I don't mean shut up, but to feel the great space where you can accept all that's here. It's all here. All the characteristics are here. And we're not apart from any of them. The third characteristic, and yet that dynamic is empty. It's in movement. It's not fixed. The third one, he says, Buddha's silence, he describes as devotion. Silence is full of devotion. Self-centered life is thrown away to wholeness. A whole life is characterized by commitment and love, wisdom, and prayer. And prayer in this sense is not something directed from a particular subject to a particular object with the expectation of a result. Like you pray for something and then you're hoping that it's going to result in something. It's more open than that, right? Simone Weil, I always loved, if I'm saying her name right, am I? What? Simone Weil. She calls prayer unmixed attention. Unmixed attention. Like just what that is, that thunderous silence, unmixed attention in prayer. That is the kind of silent devotion the Buddha was offering at that moment. Yeah. Ayo also spoke about vulnerability and deeply listening to each other's vulnerability and not using that vulnerability as a weapon, not using someone's or your own vulnerability to attack someone. That kind of devotion in that prayer, in that unmixed attention, in that devotion, in that silence, that thunderous silence of impermanence, that you hear that, you can listen to that. And it's a gift. It's a gift to receive and to give that. And it's not used. The fourth characteristics of silence is magnanimity, a kind of generosity or elasticity. I spoke about this morning, having an elastic life, a plasticity to us, because we're moving. And when we stop the movement with our thoughts and our rigidity of our mind, that's the pain, that's the suffering. We're stopping something. And we're looking for how do we release that. And I really felt that when I was laying in my bed and I have a shagbark hickory outside my window. And that 2 weeks ago, did you experience those wild winds? Like there's just these wild, wild winds, unrelenting, like these wind deities, I don't know how many of them there were. They were all there. They were shaking the earth like wildness. And I don't know if you've been in an earthquake. My first earthquake experience was there was a few in Pennsylvania where there were small ones. I thought my brother was sneaking up on me and shaking my bed. And I was like, Barry, stop it. It turned out it was an earthquake. But, because he would do that. But I remember in New Zealand, I was laying in I had a motel room at the time, and like my bureau, like bent in a way that I never saw a bureau do, and I wasn't on anything, and I didn't have jet lag. And this shagbark hickory came alive like a person, and it was like bending and moving like I'd never seen a tree do before. And nothing broke. And you see that with trees, like if they get rigid and stiff, that's why they like can't, they're so soft inside. So it's kind of like our posture. It's like we remain soft inside, but we have this architecture that holds us. So it's kind of getting those two in alignment, where we can remain soft inside, but yet we're holding ourselves up as well. But we have to be elastic. So that's what he says, is the silence has to have that kind of elasticity, that magnanimity of being movable. And Buddha's teachings, of course, are vast. They're vast and characteristic. There's nothing to pin down. They don't do that. There's no dogma in Buddhist teachings. It's just not like that. It's very vast. And that's why this Buddha's silence is so important to us. It's just so vast. And he's pointing to our vastness. So we sit down to do zazen, and we put ourselves right in the middle of the universe. And we master ourselves there. We taste silence with our whole body and enter the wholeness with everything here, with the doors, with the floor, with the trees, with each other. Something we can't pin on. And the more we practice, the more wonderful flavors and tastes ooze from our study, from our effort, from our life. It's tasty. And difficult to tell others how tasty it is, because it's impermanent and it's not something we can pin down. But we can sure share it. Like last night, or one of these nights this week, I leaned against a soji screen. And it wasn't a wall. Of course, it fell right over, but right at that moment, it felt like a wall. But it just went, ba-dunk. That's how words and forms are. In impermanence. We lean on them, but they fall. They fall. And painters and poets, what Hakuin's doing, he's trying to express silence using materials. We use words, we use music, we dance. There's always an experience of lack, of complete satisfaction. I was talking about this on the Art Zoom. Because silence is not something that completely can be expressed in a painting or a poem or in our activity. And that is our life. And that is the key. That is the energy of art. That is the energy of our highest art, of the precepts, is that it can't be completed. And we have to live with that. We have to live with that. That is our complete, whole, complete, perfect life. And we can't do anything but keep trying to express the ungraspable with each other, the impermanence. And sometimes I just make noise. Oh! It's like a suffering that can't be stopped just because we're human and having a body and a mind. And so what do? We settle into stillness and silence of this breath, breathing, body, and just depend on that sadness to be there and accept it and meet it with patience, with joyful effort, with generosity, with loving kindness. It keeps us connected. Like, compassion is to suffer with. To suffer with. And then we can understand it in others. And there, know our fear, know their fear, because we are one of the same in that way. Zen teaching emphasizes right here, right now, because we always have the opportunity to touch silence. It takes a moment. You know, people say, you know, it's like, I'm not practicing. I always like, what does that mean? And it turns out they say, I haven't sat for a while. So don't put those two together. Like, if you've started to practice, sorry, you've gone too far. You just can't not practice. You can't turn, it's going to be really hard to turn that back, turn that dial back. Not sitting is one thing, and to make contact with why you need to sit down and be still and silent is really upon each of us to make that contact, because that's going to help you. I can't tell you how tasty that is. I can tell you, but you got to taste it. It's so tasty. But teachers keep telling us and pointing, and for me too. But we only can tell the water is cold if we drink it ourselves. Is this cold? I wonder if this is cold. Ryan, can you tell me, is this cold? No. So. What's cold? So you're the walking temple, is what I'm saying. We've come to this temple, but we're each a walking temple. And you can go in that door, door's open, you just turn around in a breath, and you will find stillness, spaciousness, and deep silence. Like, in that moment, just take a breath. You're in the door. And be there. Stillness, spaciousness, and silence, and then you can move. I think that's the singing and dancing and the voice of the law. Let it arrest you. Let's all get arrested. Let's all get arrested.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.